Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where frontline sales leaders teach you how to build and scale an outbound sales team.
This episode of the Predictable Revenue Podcast is brought to you by SDR Pods. Learn how we can build you a fully equipped sales development team to execute on personalized multi-channel prospecting and book you more meetings at the link below. The ultimate fear in trying to grow your startup is losing all the elements that made it successful in the first place. Whether that's the people who have been with you since the beginning, a founder wearing many hats running out of bandwidth, or feeling that imposing rules and processes is going to suppress the creativity and the interdepartmental collaboration and that real startup culture that you always had. But if you can't find an effective way to shed what needs shedding and to keep what needs keeping, you're never going to grow. I'm your host, Sarah Hicks, and on today's episode of the Predictable Revenue Podcast, I'm going to be chatting to an expert about how to scale your business so it sells like a Fortune 500 with the culture and agility of a startup. Having worked with many diverse startups and corporations over the last 25 years, she's experienced that most companies fall apart once they start to scale. As a solution to this business time bomb, she created the Whirlpool Effect, a revolutionary way to align your leaders and teams around a unifying vision that attracts, retains, and motivates the right talent to achieve your mission. Her simple yet powerful process is helping many companies find and fix bottlenecks that are choking their business performance so they can rapidly scale without their growing pains. She'll turn you into the leader your people can't wait to follow. Claire Chandler, welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast.
Thanks, Sarah. Thank you for that introduction. It's great to be here.
Yeah, of course. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Claire, you obviously have a ton of experience scaling startups, but before we get into how to do that effectively, tell us a bit about how you got where you are today.
Sure. So I spent close to 20 years in corporate America after swearing that I would never work in corporate. So I learned very quickly never to say never, but I consider myself a corporate survivor, but in 2011, I was on an executive track. I was a vice president of human resources, and I was being groomed for an executive track, and really kind of forced myself into some reflection about the path that I was on, and came to the realization that I was really not, the journey that I was on and the path that I was on were really not what I was passionate about. And so after doing a lot of soul searching around, kind of that reality, I decided to take a bit of a leap of faith. And so in October of that year in 2011, I left corporate America, went out on my own, more so, as I say, on a leap of faith than on an actual plan. But, spent those first couple of years really finding my footing, really starting to establish myself as a brand, as opposed to, Claire, the corporate VP of HR. What was Claire Chandler, standalone entrepreneur, going to be all about? And what was I going to offer the world? And so it was an interesting journey and, met a lot of great people, worked with a lot of great clients, dabbled in a lot of different areas. Until I really established my niche, which is what I formed my company, Talent Boost, around. So I formed Talent Boost in September of 2013. And it's really focused on a lot of what you said in your introduction of me, which is to really help leaders and their teams scale with fewer growing pains, with fewer bottlenecks to their performance and their forward growth. And really help them evolve and mature from the practices and the mindsets that had gotten them to this point, which they knew were not going to fully serve them and get them to the next plateau. So that's really what I specialize in.
Gotcha. Awesome. And that's what you're going to help us with today.
Absolutely.
So without further ado, let's get into some of it. So what makes a great company a great company to work for? One of those things that comes to mind, first of all, is obviously culture. That's that's kind of paramount to kind of a nice workplace, a great place to work. Why is culture so important, do you think?
What a great leading question. So culture is hugely important. And I think leaders really underestimated and undervalued the impact of an effective culture, both a workplace culture, a performance culture, a mindset culture, and its impact on that company's bottom line. Until recently, I think leaders are really have really come around to the fact that you either proactively and intentionally form and build and sustain and protect your culture, or it is going to be formed organically, and it's going to bubble up from the bottom up, and it's also going to be fed from the top down. And you know, in my work with leaders, I have come to believe quite strongly that the biggest impact on a company's culture is the behavior of its leaders, because employees are watching, right? Employees watch who gets promoted, what gets rewarded, what behavior is tolerated, and you know, the level to which innovation, ideas, input are valued and incorporated into the, you know, the vision and the strategy of the company. So culture is really the strongest magnet that you have as a company. And as we know, magnets can do two things, right? It can attract and it can repel. If you are working on that magnet, you know, proactively, positively, intentionally, it serves to attract the right talent to your team and to repel people that really aren't going to serve you best. If, on the other hand, you have allowed and permitted a toxic culture, the same rules apply with that magnet. You are going to attract additional toxic behavior, toxic talent, you know, and toxic levels of performance, and you're going to drive your truly great performers right out of your company. So culture, it's such a great question. It's such a powerful question because it is truly, you know, kind of the gravity that holds everything else together in a company.
Right. So what are the key elements to a good culture, a positive culture?
Yeah. So one of the things is clarity. And, you know, that sounds like such a simple word, but let me kind of explain that. So usually when I work with a company, they are coming to me with some sort of pain points, headaches, symptoms. And they're saying to me, you know, we've lost a lot of really good employees lately, or, you know, our customer complaints are rising, or people are just not innovating enough. And there's something broken or, you know, not performing as well as it should be in our culture, right? So they're starting to acknowledge that there's something about the culture that's not quite, you know, working. And so the symptoms may vary that are, you know, top of mind for that leader when they come to me, or when they finally acknowledge, you know, they've got a big enough problem that they've got to bring in some outside help to help them address. But I always start with the same thing. I say, we have to get really, really clear on your mission. And I don't mean I want you to be able to recite your mission statement as you've got it on the website. You know, your mission statement really couldn't be more different than your mission. Your mission statement is for your stockholders, you know, your stockholders, your shareholders, you know, the passersby to your website. You know, it's kind of something you feel you need to have. But a mission is that core fundamental purpose that your company is all about. And that is absolutely the foundation for the right culture, the right people, the right processes, and the right way forward. So that's the number one component of culture. If you get the mission right and you make it so that every person in your organization at any level can visibly see a connection between what their role is, what they're being asked to do, and how it helps move the needle toward that mission, you're going to have a very positive magnetic culture.
Okay. Can you give us an example of maybe a client that you've worked with of what types of kind of missions they have? So not the mission statement, not what's on the website, not what we're saying to as you mentioned, the shareholders to clients, but that kind of internal mission. Can you give us an example of one that in your experience was part of a positive culture?
Sure, absolutely. So I'll tell you a quick story about the best CEO I ever worked for. And it really informed the work that I do and kind of impacted the work that I would do in the future after working for him. So this was a CEO of a very large global company. And it was his last CEO assignment before he kind of downshifted and phased into retirement. So this was a very experienced gentleman. And he came into the company at a time when they had just gone through a period of downsizing and sort of reforming what they were going to be about. So there was a lot of uncertainty. The culture had some cracks in its foundation. You know, the people that were still in the company had survivor guilt, right? And which is a very real thing. And even the leaders sort of had this, I don't want to quite call it Stockholm syndrome, but they sort of were shell-shocked after the period of downsizing and cutbacks and layoffs and retrenching. So he comes in on the heels of that. And a lot of CEOs would have come in at that phase and said, we're going to change everything about what we do in the company. And we're going to just, you know, everything you had in motion, we're going to just, you know, break that apart and do something different because obviously that's not working. He didn't do that. He spent the first 30 days in that role, traveling the country, meeting with groups of employees and listening to them, not selling them on his idea, you know, of what the company should be about, of listening to them. What were the, what were their pain points? What were they hearing? What were they experiencing? What did they need? And after those 30 days, he came back around and he said, we're going to be about three things. We're going to be about employees, customers, and efficiency. And that doesn't sound like a mission, right, on the surface, because that is about as simplistic and fundamental as you can get. And this was a company that had a very flowery mission statement that nobody could recite, didn't really mean anything. It was a bunch of corporate words that really were total, you know, crap. But so he took these three words and they became the pillars for the company. And what's so great about that is every single person from the executive leadership team to the frontline union worker could relate to at least one, if not all three of those pillars. And they could see how the job that they did, the role that they played, in some way impacted and contributed to at least one of those three things, employees, customers, or efficiency. And if you go back there now and you ask any of the employees who were there under the CEO's tenure, what were the three most important things as part of his mission, they would be able to tell you. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really powerful thing. And it was such a lesson to me that missions do not have to be complex. They do not have to be filled with, you know, million-dollar vocabulary words. And in fact, that works against you. The simpler, the more sticky in terms of, you know, going back to that magnetic concept, mm-hmm. that really formed a culture of builders. Because what happened was every single person, you know, they had transitioned from this period of downsizing and downshifting and layoffs and all of that. They shed their survivor guilt and they said, okay, we're going to reform and rebuild and now innovate and contribute in higher ways around these three things. And it really energized the company and it brought in this period of growth and flourishment that the company had not seen in many years.
That's amazing. What a great example.
He was a cool guy. He was really cool. A tremendous guy. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're listening right now, if you're a founder, take a second to think about that. What is your mission for this company? It's not the mission statement, but it's something simple. It's something magnetic, as Claire said. It's something that every single person in the company can be working towards daily. Every single kind of action they take, every task that they perform is working towards this mission. So take a second to think about that. And a really interesting thing, Claire, about that example for me was the fact that that CEO, even though he was part of a very large company, went out and got the input of all of these employees. I think that ties us back to the kind of key theme here, which is that's something that is much easier to do in a startup. If everyone's, you know, in the office together, right. It's like the bullpen and I could throw a piece of paper at the CEO over there and, you right. know, the CFO's to my left or whatever. It's so much easier to have that kind of collaborative feel. So, and that's something that really, I think, makes startup cultures often really lovely is that ability to kind of collaborate and chat. And as you mentioned, like innovate and all of these things are happening sort of organically when we're all right. in that small space. So how do you retain those elements as you start to grow the company?
Yeah, it is so critical that you do that. And it is one of the hardest things you're ever going to do, right? Because you can't just get a big old needle and withdraw from the founder, you know, some DNA and then infuse it in every new person, in every new division, in every new state or new country that you open an office in. And you're right. There is something so magical and so exciting about being part of that, those early days of, you know, remember when we didn't even have walls, right? And we didn't even have, you know, paint, and there were like, you know, dents in the wall, but we were excited. And it was like, you know, the early days of Facebook kind of thing. Like it was just, everybody came in, wore what they want, did what they wanted, and created something that built toward this thing. So how do you take that and how do you bottle that up? And one of the things you have to do is, you know, and I'm going to go kind of old school here. If you picture a Venn diagram, you have kind of like these three overlapping circles, right? If you kind of take in the first circle, what I'll call sort of your past state, your creation story, what are some of the things that led that founder or that small group of partners or leaders to form that company in the first place, right? What was some of what drove that origin? What were some of the things that you were all about? Why did that matter? Who were some of the early clients that you served? And what was so unique about what you did? Capture that in that first circle, right? Now kind of go to, okay, we're in present day. What are the priorities that we're looking at today, this month, this quarter, this year? And start to identify, you know, what's fundamental about those? What are the clients that we love and what's unique about those? Who are some of our star performers and what are some of the traits they possess, right? And kind of put a circle or ring fence around that. And then the third circle, as you've probably guessed, is the future, right? What's the vision for where we want to go? Why is that important? Why is it so important that we pull everybody in that direction? Who, you know, what are some of the skills? What are some of the capabilities and competencies that we're going to need to get us there? And the more you flesh those out, and again, these are kind of basic sounding questions, right? It's the who, it's the what, it's the where, it's the why. The more you flesh those out and bring those circles until they overlap, there's a sweet spot there. And you know, you said in your opening comments, which I think is so important, you also have to decide what you're going to let go from your past. Because as the great Marshall Goldsmith would say, what got you here is not going to get you there, right? Some of the things that you did and that you focused on and paid attention to in the early days are not necessarily what you're going to need as your company reaches adolescence. And it's certainly not what your customers are going to be expecting from you in terms of behavior and mindset and sophistication
right
down the line, right? So kind of bringing those three circles together and saying, where is that sweet spot among the three? The mission, as you start to evolve it, is really going to emerge. Mm-hmm. And that mission is going to be, you know, when you first start out, those small companies, the startups, are expressions of the founder's personality. You don't have to lose that as you grow. You want to take the best of that and move that into the sweet spot of who you are now and what is working well for you, what you want to aspire to be and what's going to move you forward, and keep that, you know, along while leaving behind the other baggage that no longer is going to serve you.
Got it. So you want to distill the great bits of your creation story, the great bits of your kind of foundation of your beginnings, and then your current priorities. And then finally your vision for the future. And you want to distill all the best things out of all of those. And then
right.
Once those kind of three circles, as you say, overlap in that Venn diagram, it's in there that you'll find that mission, that true mission, not the flowery statement, but what you guys really are all about.
Yeah. And what's great about this is, and I really should shut up because I'm going to talk myself out of a future consulting gig. Entrepreneurs can do this on their own. You don't necessarily need to pay somebody to come in and facilitate that part of the conversation. You can literally, even if you're a one-person shop, you know, you're a solopreneur, you're just starting out, or you're even just sort of refining how you're going to take what you've started to that next plateau. You can do this on the back of an envelope, on a flip chart page. You don't have to have somebody like me come in and walk you through that, because the answers to those questions are within you. And those first questions are very simple and they're very foundational. So, you know, I think anybody listening to this, that's a great first assignment, if you will. Not sure they all came here looking for homework, but we're going to give it to them anyway, right? to really kind of take those circles and, you know, flesh them out to the extent that you can. You know, it's often hard for us to see our own forest, but when you break it down like that, these are questions that anybody can ask, and will really help you distill, as you said, you know, the finest of what you want to bottle up and bring forward.
Amazing. I want to get back to something you mentioned a couple of minutes ago, and it was in this example of your great CEO. You mentioned the company had struggled. Of course, that's why they brought him on. And the people that were still there had kind of a survivor's guilt, and you mentioned the word kind of shell-shocked about things. And I think that is particularly poignant right now, because that's kind of the position that a lot of companies are in. Even the companies that have managed to keep all their people, big, you know, structural changes have happened. And there's a lot that's different. Maybe a workforce is now completely remote that used to be in this wonderful office with the dents and the poster hanging on the wall. How do you think, specifically in the instance where now we're moving to a remote workforce, how do you think we retain those elements of culture for this specific instance?
Yeah, great question. You know, I think this time that we're living in, as unprecedented as it is, I'm an eternal optimist, and I always look for what's the silver lining, what are the opportunities. You know, when a client calls me and says, "We just lost a superstar performer," I say, okay, this is your opportunity to bring on somebody who's even more of the right talent for you, right? Mm-hmm. So when I look at what COVID has done to impact businesses, and it has forced a lot of businesses to close, you know, we can't ignore that reality. And it has forced a lot of other companies to furlough or lay off, you know, workforce. So as you say, survivor guilt is a very real, globally felt kind of a thing right now. I still want all of us to look for what are the opportunities in that. You know, one of which is we're still not fully going forward full steam ahead. As much as I encourage clients and prospects and, you know, audiences to maintain that one eye on the longer term horizon and not just focus on the firefighting and the, you know, keeping the lights on, it's very difficult. You know, it's easy to say that, and it's very aspirational to say that, but it's hard to do because we're not totally out of the woods yet. But one of the things we can do, especially with those companies that have pivoted to more of a remote sort of way of working, is to take this time to reflect, not hibernate, but to reflect and say, we were forced to pivot when perhaps we had convinced ourselves we weren't quite ready, but we didn't have a choice and we've done it anyway. What are some of the things that we stopped doing and have not missed, right? You know, I think the biggest thing that this has changed for a lot of businesses is not so much who they are and what they're going to be about, but how they get their work done. And the how is always going to evolve more so than your why or your who, right? It's how you get from A to B. How do you do it more and more efficiently, more and more effectively, while maintaining as high of a standard of product and service delivery, customer satisfaction, employee loyalty, and all of those things. You know, one of the other, so that's kind of a key point. One of the other things I think that has been interesting to see is the pivot of these workforces to a more remote way of working has actually improved productivity, has actually improved morale. And this is not a, you know, this is not a 100% true for everybody, but I've seen it in many cases, you know, where employees are saying, I wasn't sure I was going to like this sort of, you know, working in one room while the kids are knocking on the door and they need their meals and, you know, the dog needs to be walked and the laundry needs to be done, et cetera. But they're finding that after those first kind of bumpy days, they've gotten into a rhythm where they can log in a little bit earlier than they might have because they don't have a commute. They can take, you know, chunks in the middle of the day to help their kids with homework because now we all had to homeschool, right? To a certain extent, we had to do, you know, learning remotely, make the meals, walk the dog, do the laundry. And then we can log back in when, you know, we're ready to focus again. So productivity has actually gone up in many, many cases. The other thing that I've seen is that collaboration has increased, which feels counterintuitive, but because of the technology that we've got available to us, we're talking on Zoom right now. You know, a lot of companies have made much better use of video technology and collaborative tools. So where, you know, you and I may have worked, you know, in offices next to each other in a physical location, we often would take for granted, okay, at some point I got to catch up with Sarah on this project. Well, now we're more intentional about, I've got to carve out time where I can be fully present and there's no distractions because people are calling out, hey, I'm going to go order pizza. What do you want on your slice, right? We don't have that now. We have just sort of this intentional carving out of time to work on projects and to solve problems. So the collaboration has gone up. I think one of the things that kind of gets to the root of your question that has taken a little bit of a hit, and leaders need to pay particular attention to this and focus some time on it, is while collaboration has increased, connection kind of drops. You know, and it's the same sort of false sense of connection that we all have who are on Facebook. We think, wow, I have so many friends from, you know, high school and from grammar school and from the street I grew up on that I'm reconnected with. Are you really? I mean, really all you are is linked to whatever feed they want you to see about their lives, but we're not actually getting together with them physically. I mean, if we are, that's wonderful. But so I think, you know, that's kind of a caveat for leaders, especially in a startup culture like you described, where they went from all being in the same room, you know, being able to sort of huddle together, get in the bullpen, whatever, you know, be a one paper ball's throw away from connecting with somebody else physically, right? And now they've shifted to remote. And so it's really, really important to, as a leader, to check in one-on-one with as many of your team as possible. And also, if you're a startup whose culture was normally about huddling at different times of the day, you know, maybe sending people out for the weekend with a clap out or whatever you do, you can do that through technology. You can do that through Zoom. You know, I've seen, there's a company, they're not a client of mine, but I know them very well, that normally has a manager's conference of 200 employees that they meet every year. Well, they canceled it this year for obvious reasons. They held it on, I don't know if it was on Zoom or Microsoft Teams, but they literally had little windows of all 200 people. Not quite the same, you know, it's not quite the same as sort of, you know, ducking out and certainly going to happy hours, you know, every night. But there's something to be said about that. And I think, you know, leaders and founders, and especially in a startup kind of an environment, you've got to pay particular attention to what are the things that you're missing from the social side of things. Make time for that, instigate those and facilitate them, because that's the part that your employees are, you know, hungering for.
Absolutely. So kind of the key takeaways here are, number one, look at what you don't actually miss. What are the things that aren't actually wasting time? What are the parts of being in person that are actually okay to be left kind of there in the past? Keep your finger on the pulse with the team, and make sure that you actually know what's going on. Because as you mentioned, there's this ability to kind of look at all the work that's being done without checking individually on anybody and think, oh, everything is perfect, it's all going great, it's all going smoothly. But you need, as a leader, to kind of make sure that you're actually checking in with your people. Right. And then find a way to replace these great social occasions or events or whatever made your company what it was. Make sure you find a way to replace those, because as you're saying, and I can agree as somebody who was in an office, those are the parts that we miss. It's the getting together and the fun stuff. So find a way to kind of work that into this virtual life.
Absolutely.
So since a lot of the listeners on the line right now, and a lot of our kind of predictable revenue listeners in general are sales practitioners and sales leaders, I'm going to gear this question to sales. And you kind of mentioned it actually in your example there about if a founder comes to you and says, oh no, I've just lost a great producer, top producers, top sales talent. And you say, okay, well, there's a silver lining. There's an opportunity maybe to hire somebody even better. So a vital step to scaling a company is always going to be bringing on more people. That makes sense. That's a no-brainer. But then the people are integral to the culture. So how do you make sure that each person that you bring on, and we'll say specifically in this instance, the sales force, how do you make sure that you're hiring the right sales force that fits into that company culture?
Yeah. And sales, great question. And sales particularly is a function that is often taken for granted in terms of making sure that they mesh with everybody else, you know, because they're so outwardly focused, right? And it's interesting because really good salespeople are extremely skilled and extremely competent at building and nurturing and cultivating relationships with prospects, with customers, with clients. But they don't necessarily focus that same amount of time and attention and effort on building and fostering and cultivating relationships with their coworkers, right? Partly because maybe they don't see them that much. And, you know, they're kind of burning all their energy on maintaining the outward relationships. But here's the thing. The sales brings in the, you know, the opportunities, right? But you feed them into operations. You have to feed them back into marketing. You have to feed them back into finance. If you don't have a good, productive, positive, proactive relationship with the people who have to deliver on what you sell, and the people who have to measure the effectiveness of that, and, you know, and the people who have to now market, you know, to the next version of customer and continually refine, you know, the offers and the market research, et cetera, you're literally leaving money on the table, because the people who have to execute, if, you know, they're sort of treated as you just sold something we couldn't possibly deliver in the time frame or the format that you've promised. Mm. It really is a, you know, it damages the relationship on both ends, right? Mm. It damages the relationship of the operations or the execution arm of your company in the eyes of sales, because they say, well, now you're making me look bad because I made this commitment to the client and now you're saying it's not going to be ready or it's not, you know, going to be of the standard they're requiring. But you're also damaging the reputation, obviously, of that salesperson who really should have done their internal due diligence as much as they did their external due diligence. Mm-hmm. And we all know some clients don't want to hear about your limitations, right? And they just want you to say right on the spot, yes, we can deliver that. But if you don't have that relationship on the back end where you've built up some equity to say, there are going to be times like that where I'm going to have to promise, you know, sort of overpromise something, but I'm, you know, I'm here with you and I'm going to learn from you, you know, realistically, what are the expectations I need to set? You know, if done right, your sales arm is your research and development arm of the company, right? They are constantly nurturing those relationships with the customers. They are constantly looking for not just what they need today, but what they're not saying and what they're going to need in the future. And if they've got a positive relationship with the people in the back room who are executing and researching and marketing, et cetera, if they've got that positive relationship, they can take that market research, that, you know, that frontline research back to them and say, here's what's going to come down the road. And it will continually innovate and evolve the company and their ability to get out in front of, you know, the next thing the customer wants. And so saying all of that is just sort of the, you know, this is kind of what's required. Some people would say sales is sales is sales, right? It's such a transferable skill. And if you're a superstar in one company or one industry, you're going to be able to, you know, do that just as effectively somewhere else. I have seen more salespeople fail moving from one company to another who have been hired on, you know, their past track record, testimonials of clients and customers, et cetera, who have absolutely flamed out in a new organization because the internal relationships aren't worked properly. The leadership sees the sales arm as a necessary evil, but not integral to, you know, the growth of the company. Mm-hmm. There are, you know, a myriad factors for why salespeople specifically, but any role, can, you know, can flame out. And it's exactly what you're pinpointing. It's when there is a mismatch with the culture and, you know, that talent that you bring on, if they don't embrace the mission that you have and what you're trying to build, they're going to either fail or they're just not going to bring it to the level that you were hoping for.
Okay. So if I'm a founder or a leader that's hiring for sales talent, what do I want to look for in the interview process or in getting to know that candidate so that I can kind of do some kind of internal test for myself to see if they do match up with this culture that I've created?
Right. First thing is, before you hire the next person, whether it's a salesperson or anybody, make absolutely sure you are crystal clear on your mission. I don't mean to keep repeating that, but it is so foundational, right? If you are not, as a leader and everybody down the chain who might possibly interact with this prospective candidate, if you are not completely clear on your mission, and don't understand it, don't embrace it, don't commit to it, and don't see how you connect to it and how other people can connect to it. You know, as they say in sales, if you don't believe it, you can't sell it, right? And the same holds true for anybody that you're trying to bring in. You know, I've had this conversation with a couple of clients who say, hey, you know, the unemployment, you know, rate is rising, which means there is talent out there ripe for the pickings. Quantity does not necessarily imply quality, and not every, you know, not all talent is created equal. And like I said, you can have a superstar in one company, you pluck them out of there, you put them into your situation, and they can flame out. So that's sort of rule number one, is to get really, really clear on your mission. Once you do that, the second piece of that, and it's part of the work that I do with my clients, is to say, okay, now that we know that this is your mission, what are some of the fundamental skills and behaviors and competencies and mindset that are going to help drive that mission forward? And those answers are different in every single company. There's no, you know, I can't just give you an inventory and say, check off the top 10 things that are going to be important, right? They're very unique. It's a very customized type of a thing. But once you have that and you say, okay, based on if this is sort of the basket of fundamentals that we need, let's do a little bit of a gap analysis with what we have. Because we may have some people that are already super strong in these fundamentals, but upon analysis, we're very exposed here. Mm. And that sounds like, oh my gosh, Claire, that's such a long process before I can hire the next person. I mean, you're talking about getting mission clarity. Now I've got to do fundamentals. I've got to do a gap analysis. If you're committed to the process and you understand why that's so important, it doesn't have to take very long at all, but it's going to pay off in dividends, because unless you like to hire over and over for the same position because you've created a revolving door, you really need to pay attention to what I'm saying. And you have to be, you know, have that as your lens to say, okay, now we're clear on the mission. Now we know the fundamentals we're going to need to get us there. Now we know what we've got and what we lack. Now let's go into those conversations. And it's partly through the conversation, the way you attract people into the room to interview them, behavioral interviewing techniques that are going to get to some of the root of what truly drives that person. And does that align with what we're looking for? You know, there are things like assessment tools that will help mm-hmm. you quantify that as well. So there are a lot of different ways. Once you're armed, it's sort of like being an educated consumer, right? You want to be fully armed before you talk to that next candidate with, this is what I'm looking for. And I will now know it when we interact, because they're not going to be able to hide their true selves if I know, you know, how to ask for what I'm looking for.
Awesome. So we know who the right types of people are. We've nailed that down. We've brought on these great, great salespeople. We're retaining them. As you mentioned, it's not this revolving door, because part of that was a culture not fit issue.
Right.
So
right.
We've got them, they're staying. How do we keep up the momentum as we're scaling? What's kind of the next step in making sure we can replicate on the success that we've had?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and it's not easy, right? It may sound simple, but it's not easy. Part of it is, as you continue to scale, you want to make sure that, you know, the inclusiveness, the sort of teamwork huddle vibe that you had as a startup, that you keep going. And sure, it's more complicated because now you're in different locations and, you know, a significant portion of you stayed remote. So you're only kind of coming into the office at certain times, and otherwise you're only on video. You know, and now you're expanding across the country, so you've got time zones to contend with. But the same rules apply. So as you grow and you scale, you still want to huddle, so to speak, and fold in the input, the insights, the reactions to where you want to go. You know, we talk a lot about, you know, this buzzword of transparency, but it's a buzzword for a reason, because it's important, right? So at the highest levels, executive leadership can't, you know, give away all the secrets that they talk about in the boardroom necessarily. But they have to be transparent enough about why we're going in this direction, why that matters. And if it's a little bit of a change in course, we want to make sure we're using our turn signals to make sure that, you know, the people that are trying to follow us don't have to all of a sudden cut across three lanes of high speed traffic because we made a knee jerk decision and we forgot to tell everybody, you know, where we're going. The power of why, which obviously is around the mission as well, you know, why we're in existence and why this matters and why we do what we do. But the why behind the decisions that you make about where you're going to grow, when and how, who you're going to hire, right, and what they're going to be doing. Taking those extra couple of seconds to explain the why behind your directives and your decisions is hugely powerful. And being open to the fact that as a founder, you don't know everything and you can't do everything. It's the whole reason why you brought on other people to begin with, right? To kind of complement your skills, to bring different perspectives that perhaps you haven't thought of, to bulletproof your ideas so that you can not only catch up to your competition, but absolutely trounce them year after year, right? So those are just some hugely important things to do.
Amazing. So kind of to continue your road analogy there, I really like that. So you, of course, yeah, you've got to let your people know we're taking a hard left. We're going to New York. We're not going to New Jersey anymore. I don't even know.
That's fine.
Yeah, exactly. We're going. So not only do you, of course, need to tell them, all right, indicate we're all heading left in this convoy.
Right.
But why? Why are we going to New York now instead of New Jersey? I thought we were going to New Jersey. It totally makes sense that, yeah, for this kind of direction, as you mentioned, for everybody to feel that buy-in into that mission, everybody needs to know why the decisions are being made so that they can agree. And then, yeah, put their everything behind that new decision and help. It's almost like if you're thinking of more travel analogies, if it was like a massive boat and one person's trying to turn like a tiny fin and get the whole thing to go,
right,
get the people on the oars to pop right them out and help you make the big turn, and things will go so much more smoothly. That totally makes sense to me. Is there any kind of like structured framework or anything that you recommend to kind of startups that are looking to scale this kind of thing? Like any, yeah, very structured process that they should start to follow?
Yeah. So what I typically do, so I'm really going to talk myself out of some consulting gigs here, but that's okay. So I talked about, you know, the importance being that very first thing is getting clear on your mission. The second thing being, you know, what are the fundamentals that are going to be required to move that forward? And the third one being, you know, and what those gaps are that you want to fill. You know, the next step from that is, what are some of the strengths you already have on your team that you can leverage, right? Of those fundamentals, we talked about the importance of zeroing in on where your gaps are so you can hire and fill those gaps strategically and intentionally. But of course, the upside is you're going to have a lot of strengths already on your team. Acknowledge those, recognize those, reward those, bring those out more. And let people play to their strengths. So what are some of the strengths that you can leverage that are already on your team? You'd be surprised how many people have a lot of strengths that they've been kind of put into a role where they barely get to use those. So really kind of using that again as a lens to say, you know, this is somebody who's really good over here. Why on earth do we have them in this position? Because a lot of times you have the right talent, they're just not in the right seats, right? So there's that piece as well. And then you want to look at, you know, what are some of the obstacles that are standing in your way of achieving your mission, and how can you turn those into opportunities instead? You know, and again, it may be simply kind of reorganizing who you've got, focusing on what, so that they're more aligned with their strengths. And then I can't emphasize enough, especially when you're starting out. Not just as a startup, but as you're starting to do your first scaling, your first growth, identifying quick wins. You know, it is important to know what long-term success looks like, so you know it when you see it and you celebrate it. But there are quick wins that are going to help you get some momentum and propel people, you know, forward, because it is a lot of work in the beginning. I mean, just putting a startup in and surviving, you know, those awful statistics of failure rates of startups, right? And overcoming that is hard work. Well, now you have to not rest on that and say, well, we're just going to operate in startup mode, you know, for the next 30 years until the founder dies. Well, that's not helpful, right? We've got to pivot. We've got to evolve. And so, you know, quick wins along the way that infuse you with a little bit more energy to keep going. are really important. So if you picture mission being kind of the groundwork, that clarity, you get your fundamentals right, you leverage your strengths, you turn obstacles into opportunities, and you identify quick wins. That spells out flow. You've got fundamentals, leverage, opportunities, wins. I typically do that in more of a workshop setting. I know I just went through that kind of fast, but if you play this back, you kind of slow it down, or even, you know, you want to hop on a call with me for 30 minutes, I can do a deeper dive for no cost. If you do that, what you end up kind of mapping out is literally not to get punny about it, but a flow chart, right? A roadmap for, if this is our mission and now we're super clear on that, what are some of those first steps we need to take? There's a lot, obviously, that comes up after that. You know, challenges, as you evolve and you get to a higher level in your business, you're going to come across higher challenges. You're going to come across more complex obstacles. You're going to come across, issues and opportunities. Again, eternal optimist, right? So looking at those as opportunities to kind of kick up your game and innovate. But if you start with that mission clarity and then you kind of map out your flow chart for how you're going to get there, if you take some time to just do that and involve as many people as you can in that process, because people support what they help to create, you're going to save yourself time down the line of having to try to go out and sell that to your employees. If they were involved from the beginning of, you know, building your map toward the future, there, you know, you've already gone up many, many steps in terms of building buy-in and really increasing their engagement and their commitment. So those are just a couple of quick, not so quick. They're simple. They're not easy, right? But things that you can do to try to prepare for that next stage. So, I mean, between that and the Venn diagram, boy, Sarah, we're giving them a lot of homework to do.
We are. But I think that's so vital what you just said about people wanting to work towards the thing that they've built with you. It totally makes sense, because you can't expect an employee who doesn't really understand what the ultimate goal is to, you know, work above and beyond at what they're doing to get there if they don't even know where they're trying to go.
Because they don't know what direction is beyond, yes. Right? If you want them to contribute beyond can go in 360 different degrees. So right. Which direction actually helps you go forward?
Exactly. Yeah. And as you said, it's simple, but it's not easy to execute.
That's right.
Which is why I don't think you're losing any consulting, because people are going to need your help to actually do this.
all part of my plan.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. talk to me about the idea that startups are managed by chaos.
Yeah. Okay. So, founders of startups are by nature entrepreneurs. So this is, you know, entrepreneurs, founders of startups, partners or whatever. I mentioned when you asked me to kind of take you through how I got to this point. I was in corporate, but I was restless because I knew it wasn't quite the right fit. Right. Entrepreneurs and founders feel the same way. And I can't even think of one exception of an entrepreneur or a startup founder that I've spoken to who didn't have some sort of transformative event that caused them to wake up and say, what have I been waiting for? It's time to take my shot. And so those first few months, that phase of ideation of what's going to be possible, are very chaotic. I left corporate in 2011, didn't form my business formally until 2013, and I'm still a solopreneur. It's not like I had to, like, you know, get some board of directors or advisors or you know, big workforce to buy into what I had finally sort of narrowed in as my focus. I had to get me on board with that, right? But when you're an entrepreneur or a founder, you have to get partners, advisors, angel investors, employees, customers, clients, all to kind of buy in on what you're all about, why that's different, why that matters, and all of that. And it is very chaotic. We entrepreneurs are control freaks, which is why we don't quite fit into the control, into the corporate box, because we don't really like being told what to do without the freedom to question why, right? Mm-hmm. And explore the why. So we're control freaks, but we also have many, many voices in our head. Right? We're constantly being bombarded by ideas and by thoughts and by the naysayer on this shoulder and they just go for it on this shoulder. And they're all the same person because it's you. And you tend to, in the beginning, you get so excited by the creation. You get so excited by the building. You get so excited by the, this is going to be new and different, and this is going to be a way for me to channel my personality and my passion into something that I can, you know, get clients, deliver great results, and support my family and the life that I want to live, right? It is by nature chaotic, because you can't just, you know, there's no cookie cutter. There's no roadmap that everybody can follow. Even that flow roadmap, believe me, if there were, I would be out there selling that, right? but there isn't. And so it is by nature a very chaotic start when you're forming this new world. And it's one of the reasons that people gravitate toward working for a startup, because there is this, I don't know, maybe it's the caveman in all of us that we like to build things. We like to, you know, forge our own wheel, you know, that kind of a thing. And so it's very exciting and it's very magnetic to say, wow, I'm going to go work for a startup because I get to skateboard down the hall and I get to wear whatever I want. And there's a ping pong table in the corner and that's all great. And those are the fun parts of that culture. But if over time, you know, it may be exciting at first to say, we're going to fly by the seat of our pants and we're going to make decisions like this and it's all going to be great. After a while, it turns into this frenetic, shaky foundation under which your best employees, the employees who should stay with you and contribute at higher levels, just mm-hmm. can't get their feet steady on. So managing by chaos it's a very real thing. It is extremely prevalent with entrepreneurs and with startups. And as you pivot and as you ascend to a more mature level, it's one of the reasons that you have to kind of outgrow that, mature that, do the work to bottle up what's great about that and what should not be let go, but shed some of the almost adolescent ways of forming decisions and, you know, and moving forward and bringing in revenue, because they're not going to serve you in the long run and you're going to lose people. So the excitement that they have at first is going to lead to burnout.
Yeah.
You know, you look at Elon Musk is a great example of that in his earlier businesses. He attracted people because he's a genius. He's an inventor. But he's extremely hard to work for over a long period of time.
Yeah. And I've heard the same about Steve Jobs too.
Oh, absolutely.
Just these people, yeah, that their minds are going a million miles a minute. And yeah, you can't find stable ground anywhere in there. So I think that's a great kind of segue into how founders themselves can kind of push the startup to outgrowing this managed by chaos state. In a lot of startups, as you mentioned, you yourself, even founding your consulting business, founders are wearing a ton of hats at the beginning because you don't have a head of each single department to help you with everything. So you're doing all these things at once. And Claire, in your experience, you've helped a lot of startup leaders kind of grapple with this particular issue. What do you share with them that helps them move away from that chaos and behave like the leader of a big company?
Yeah. You've got some great questions here. You know, one of the things, again, keeping in mind that we are by nature control freaks. And when you first start out, of course, you're doing everything yourself. You know, especially if you're going to remain a solopreneur for a longer period of time. I myself am a solopreneur. And it took me a while to really accept that I don't have to do everything myself. Even if I don't bring on another employee, you know, there are processes, there are systems, there is non-revenue generating work that I'm focusing too much time on mm-hmm. that I can outsource or get rid of because it doesn't serve me anymore, right? And so, you know, for founders, that's really one of the keys to their growth and the growth and pivot and maturing of their company is to learn what they can let go. And so I do a lot of work with you know, leaders at that stage to really kind of dive deep on, you know, so hearkening back to, we've got mission clarity, and now we've established what the fundamentals are and what strengths we already possess that we want to leverage. It's the same process one-on-one with that CEO or that founder. Is to say, you're at a point where, and you've been here for a while, you just haven't kind of given yourself this credit, that you have other people around you. And now we've started to put in a little bit of structure. where you're gonna have mission clarity that you can articulate consistently, and everybody else can get behind and attach some meaning to. You're starting now to think more strategically and intentionally about who you bring on next and how you're going to vet them, right? And then, of course, how you're going to onboard them. So that structure is starting to happen. And you're noticing I'm slowing down my speech a little bit, because when you talk to a founder about bringing in structure, remember, they like to manage by chaos. And the thought of structure is, well, that's too rigid and that's too bureaucratic, and I don't want to be a corporate, you know, bureaucracy. And that's true. But your employees still need some guidance. It's kind of the same thing as parents, right? You're not supposed to be their friend. You're supposed to be their parent. You've got to give them boundaries. So we're talking about boundaries, right? We're talking about not just the fundamental structure of keeping you compliant, because the bigger you are, the more you're going to be in the gun sights of compliance agencies, whether it's OSHA, whether it's, you know, equal opportunity, you know, employment opportunity, et cetera. So you've got to be careful, but you also don't want to be so cautious that you stop doing that forward drive that made you a startup, you know, to begin with. So right. I do a lot of that kind of soul searching, deep reflecting assessment of, you know, that founder to say, you're at a point, and like I said, you've been here for a while, where you can let go what you are not, you know, completely genius at. And it's about, you know, finding what that genius zone is, or in some cases, I refer to it as your fast lane, right? You've got a fast lane, you've got sort of a transition lane, you've got a slow lane. You can offload those other things. What I find most often, and you brought up Steve Jobs and mentioned Elon Musk, they're perfect examples of this. These innovative folks who are founders and entrepreneurs and all of that, they're typically, not in every case, but they are typically really, really good at visionary, creative, innovative, strategic things, right? Mm-hmm. They want to set the vision, they want to set the horizon. But they tend to be, as a species, horrible, horrible business managers. And then there's sort of they're kind of 50-50. Some are pretty good people managers, some like Steve Jobs and Elon Musk. Their employees hate them as people, but they love where they're headed, right? And so it's really about kind of heightening that leader's self-awareness about, this is what you are supremely talented at. And here's the beauty. You could focus only on doing that stuff because you're big enough now, mm-hmm. and you're trying to mature in a direction where you can offload the business management, the people management, the compliance side, the you know, going out and getting new clients, and just stay in your fast lane. It's a difficult transition, because the first time you have to let something go as an entrepreneur, as a founder, it's very, very scary. It's like, you know, Linus, you know, the Peanuts comics with his, yeah. with his security blanket.
Yeah.
It's a traumatic thing. But once you kind of let go and you realize, wow, like I feel lighter and I feel like I can focus my entire day, my entire week on setting the vision, making course corrections, connecting with employees and, you know, getting us closer there and not worry about all this other stuff and build a more successful company because of it, then, you know, then they're full advocates for the process. So it's such an important point.
Totally. And it, of course, it makes sense that it would be difficult to part ways with all these things that you have really felt like you've controlled, or, and you ultimately have been the bringer of success in all of these different areas. But now that you're there, and as you've said, you've been there for a while, it's steady, it's repeatable. You've figured out a way to replicate the success. Now you need to hone in on what you're really good at and continue to do that. And that's kind of the biggest strength that you can bring to that company. And right. we figured out how to hire the right people and the right people for the culture and for the company. So you've got a great team around you. You've figured out how to do that. Lean on them. You brought them on for a reason. Let them do what they were brought on to do. And yeah, it's like a whole team working towards one thing rather than one person trying to pull all the bits and pieces together.
That's exactly right.
Amazing. Well, Claire, it's been so amazing having you on the show. This is such an incredible kind of arc of how to go from a complete chaotic startup to this much more structured, yet still fun and with great people type of larger company. Because I think it is a fear that you're going to lose all of these great bits that go into a startup as you're trying to grow into a larger company. But it is kind of important if you want to be able to retain those amazing people, as you mentioned, and give people kind of a stable footing, but still with those lofty ideas that you had when you were founding the company. Exactly. If people want to learn more from you, where can they do that?
I would encourage them to come see me at clairechandler.net. You can learn more about me and my background. There's a ton of free resources you can download. And there's some ways that you can connect with me and we can have a conversation. So look forward to it.
Nice. Well, thanks everyone for watching. And thank you so much, Claire, for being on the show.
Thanks. It was a pleasure. Thanks, Sarah.